Good evening. Welcome back once again to the live studio. Those of you who are taping, this is the chance to turn your tapes over. Let me tell you what you're going to be hearing. You're going to be hearing, roughly 7 minutes of concluding text on the next side. Then we're going to come back live in the studio, and I'm going to present some supplemental information. I'm going to read a little bit and also play you a short section from an old, old archive show, almost 10 years old. This dealing with the murders of a couple of people who may have had information about the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. Both of these murders, again, not definitely connected with the assassination, but murders of people who may have had information. We'll never know because they're dead, obviously. Both of these murders followed the House Select Committee on Assassinations investigation in the late 1970s. Those of you who are taping, please get ready to do so. We're going to go for about 7 minutes on tape, and then we're going to come back live, then I'm going to pop in another tape. We will take a musical break after that, and we're going to come back and review some information about the physical circumstances of Dr. King's killing. We're going to listen to a couple of speeches of Dr. King's if we have time. Certainly the Drum Major Instinct speech and probably the I Have Been to the Mountaintop speech as well. That's basically what we have on tap for this evening. We're also going to take a look at some information about Jesse Jackson's strange behavior with regard to the assassination of Martin Luther King. So those of you who are taping, please get ready to go for another 45 minutes. 3, 2, 1, here we go. Now, Mark Lane became James, in addition to his work on in the Kennedy assassination, became James Earl Ray's attorney. Now, in 1978, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, which implicated, among others, Ray attorney J.B. Stoner in the assassination of Martin Luther King. Recall Stoner also connected to the 16th Street bombing and so forth, that when the House Select Committee was hearing testimony on the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, James Earl Ray was being represented by Mark Lane. Mark Lane maintained that James Earl Ray was innocent. Lane had written a book, co-authored a book on the King assassination with Dick Gregory called Codename Zorro, and Mark Lane at that time was also representing the People's Temple. Now, we've talked at great length about the many intelligence connections to the People's Temple and Jim Jones, in particular the fact that this apparently was the People's Temple, that is, was an intelligence front. We've discussed that at some length on the last two Radio Free America shows before this one. If you'd like to contact us, if you missed that, we can tell you how to get a hold of the tapes of that broadcast. Now, as the House Select Committee on Assassinations was taking public testimony, some of the most dramatic testimony given concerned the assassination of Martin Luther King. A former FBI agent named Arthur Murtaugh was testifying about the very well-publicized COINTELPRO program, which the FBI had undertaken against not only Dr. King, but other black activists as well. And one of the things that Murtaugh said was that he was testifying that the FBI had attempted to get Dr. King to commit suicide, and at one point he actually broke down in tears while giving his public testimony, and that was one of the most dramatic moments in the public hearings of the House Select Committee. Now, that was on a Friday. The following Saturday, the People's Temple massacre occurred, in which some 900-some-odd followers of Jim Jones allegedly committed suicide. The vast majority of them were, in fact, murdered. And interestingly enough, had Mark Lane been able to work out a plan which he was apparently developing with a People's Temple member named Terry Buford, none other than Grace Walden, the very important witness who contradicted the only person ever to link James Earl Ray with the place where he supposedly fired the fatal shot at Dr. King from. She would have been down at the People's Temple had Lane been able to effect her transfer down there. Now, it's worth noting before we get into the information about Grace Walden's possible journey down to Jonestown that once the People's Temple massacre broke, nobody was paying any attention to the House Select Committee. It completely obscured the House Select Committee's public hearings. Plus, Jim Jones Mark Lane, rather, had been making a great many public appearances, making statements to the effect that Jim Jones' People's Temple was, in essence, a heaven on earth, okay? He also was saying James Earl Ray was innocent. So after the People's Temple massacre occurs, very few people are taking Mark Lane's claims of James Earl Ray's innocence seriously, since he obviously completely missed the boat on the People's Temple. Now, We're going to read an article. I'm going to read a few sections from an article from the New York Times of December 8th, 1978. This is a special New York Times article authored by Nicholas M. Horrock, H-O-R-R-O-C-K. Headlined, Memo Discusses Smuggling Witness into Guyana. Dateline, Georgetown, Guyana, December 7th. A memorandum found in the files of the Reverend Jim Jones and apparently written by an official of the People's Temple in San Francisco discussed the possibility of the cult helping its lawyer, Mark Lane, to smuggle a witness in the Martin Luther King Jr. assassination case into Guyana using a false passport. The memo, discovered among papers dated earlier this year, apparently was written by Terry Buford, who worked for the temple at the time but who is now associated with Mr. Lane. A spokesman for Mr. Lane denied, however, that he had discussed such a possibility. The memorandum marked confidential, and addressed to Jim noted, quote, I got a message over here that you wanted me to tell Mark Lane that he should look into some alternative means of getting Grace Walden to Guyana because the CIA might try to stop her from entering the country. Therefore, Mark should try to get her another passport. The memo continued, if he doesn't have those kinds of contacts, do you think we might ought to offer the tampering of Maxine Swaney's passport. We have her passport here, and it might be something that would be similar to Grace Walden, and also, if it doesn't look like her, maybe we can swap the pictures. The drawback of this would, of course, be if a traitor were to look at the immigration list, we would be caught in a minute. The good point of this would be we wouldn't run the risk of getting caught by a passport on the white market. So apparently, there were plans afoot involving Mark Lane to get Grace Walden down to Guyana, where, of course, had she been, she would no longer be, because all the people down there were deep six during the massacre. So another interesting bit of maneuvering by another very, very curious James Earl Ray lawyer, again with connections going back to the Kennedy assassination. Recall Percy Forman's contacts with Jack Ruby. Percy Forman's contacts, he represented Ruby for 4 days. His contacts with the Hunts. Recall J.B. Stoner's contacts, not only with the National States Rights Party, of which Miltier was a member, but also with the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, as well as James Earl Ray. Recall Arthur Haynes' connections to FBI, Bay of Pigs, CIA, 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, the Viola Liuzzo killing, and James Earl Ray, and the other connections between the assassinations we've talked about.
Well, that concludes the prepared portion of this broadcast.
Well, it concludes the first part of the original prepared portion of this broadcast, and we're now going to give you some additional information. This is going to go into the files, into the archives, as an addendum to Radio Free America number 8, the program that, obviously that you've just heard. Now, we've just been hearing about Grace Walden or Grace Stevens. I don't know ultimately what became of her. That Nicholas Horrock article from the New York Times is the last I personally have ever heard of Grace Walden. We're going to talk about a couple of other possible witnesses in the assassination of Martin Luther King, people who may have had first-hand information about the case, appear to have, and what happened to them. They were both murdered, and whether or not these murders had anything to do with the investigation into the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King remains to be seen. Suffice it to say that both of the figures you're going to be hearing about, one live and one in person, both of these figures were being investigated by the House Select Committee on Assassinations in the late 1970s. Both died, apparently or possibly as a result of that investigation. Reading now from the report of the Select Committee on Assassinations, U.S. House of Representatives, 95th Congress, Second Session, Findings and Recommendations. March 29, 1979, U.S. Government Printing Office, Washington, 1979. We're going to read here about a fellow named Vincent De Palma, what happened to him and what relevance he has to the assassination of Dr. King. Talking about a possible Minuteman or Minutemen connection to the assassination, the Minutemen being an ultra-right-wing paramilitary group that came to the fore in the 1960s. The report reads on page 375, a review of FBI files on the Minutemen revealed a possible plot against Dr. King's life that had received some attention by law enforcement officials shortly before Dr. King's death. On January 15, 1968, Vincent De Palma, A close associate of Robert B. Depew, the founder of the Minutemen, told a Denver agent of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms that he had defected from the Minutemen and wished to supply information. De Palma, by the way, is capital D-E, capital P-A-L-M-A. Depew is capital D-E, capital P-U-G-H. Continuing with the text. De Palma revealed that there were 19 Minutemen strike teams across the United States assigned to assassinate several prominent persons, including Dr. King, in the event Depew was ever imprisoned. Two, according to De Palma, the Minutemen also planned to incite race riots in the summer of 1968. After it received this information from the ATF, the FBI attempted unsuccessfully to locate De Palma, who had said he was moving to Oregon. As for Depew, he disappeared in February of 1968 following his indictment by a federal grand jury in Seattle, Washington for conspiracy to commit bank robbery. The FBI made no further attempts to investigate the threat until shortly after Dr. King's assassination, when one of De Palma's Minutemen associates, Edward Baumgartner, B-A-U-M-G-A-R-D-N-E-R, told a reporter that the artist's drawing of the suspected assassin resembled De Palma. Baumgartner was interviewed several times by the FBI. He said that he and De Palma were members of a Minuteman strike team that had been formed at a training camp in Colorado during the summer of 1967. Baumgartner repeated the information that De Palma had provided ATF and said De Palma had been assigned the code name Willard. James Earl Ray used the alias John Willard when renting a room in a rooming house in Memphis on April 4th, 1968. De Palma was located by the FBI several days after Dr. King was killed. He again detailed information on the Minutemen strike teams that had targeted Dr. King and on Minutemen plans to precipitate race riots in the summer of 1968 as a means of facilitating a takeover of the government. Work records showed that De Palma was in Newport, Rhode Island on April 4, 1968. Information he furnished during 3 days of interviews was verified by several FBI offices. Depew and his chief associate in the Minutemen, Walter Payson, capital P-E-Y-S-O-N, remained fugitives until their capture in July of 1969. There was nothing in the FBI files to reflect they were ever interviewed regarding possible involvement of the Minutemen in the assassination of Dr. King. The committee found that the De Palma lead had not been fully investigated by the FBI, so it examined anew. The committee found that the De Palma lead had not been fully investigated by the FBI, repeating, of course, so it examined anew. It found that De Palma had been murdered in an unsolved gangland slaying in January of 1978 in Los Angeles. So it remains to be seen just what the story is with Vincent De Palma and whether the Minuteman elements or Minuteman units were involved in any way with aspects of the assassination of Dr. King. Obviously, a question we can't answer, but equally obviously it's a question we have to ask. Frequently, groups like the Minutemen are used at low-level, lower rungs of plots of this type, perhaps as agent provocateur in some of the race riots that follow the assassination of Martin Luther King. It remains to be seen, but again, the De Palma connection is certainly one of the many open leads in the assassination of Dr. King. Also, another fellow, another possible organized crime figure, certainly an organized crime figure, someone who may have had information about the assassination of Martin Luther King, was assassinated by a bomb shortly after the House Select Committee concluded its investigation. You're going to hear now a clip from a very old archive show. This program was actually called the Backpage News, which evolved into the old Hard Rain broadcast. This program was originally broadcast on sister station KKUP in Cupertino on November 30th of 1979, so in other words, almost 10 years ago. You're going to hear the voice of my then co-host, Mark Ortiz, O-R-T-I-Z, and Mark is going to read you the article that you're going to hear. I was unable to find the original article in my files, however, I do have this on tape. Neither myself nor Mark pretends to be the next Edward R. Murrow, not now and certainly not then. This is not the most professional broadcast in the world. However, it is cogent and it's comprehensible, and so I'm going to play it here and include it in the archives for the interest purposes, because it is an interesting assassination, this of a witness, and it may have relevance to the investigation. So from the Backpage News of November 30th, 1979, here is Mark Ortiz reading an article from the San Francisco Examiner.
Bomb in Car Kills Missing Link to King Assassination. This appeared in the San Francisco Examiner Friday, November 9th. Stateline St. Louis. John Paul Spica, killed yesterday by a bomb planted in his Cadillac, had a background as a convicted underworld hitman who may have been the missing link in unraveling the Martin Luther King assassination. We're looking into several areas of his past, but we have no motive or suspects right now. Colonel Harry Slayton, head of the St. Louis Area Major Case Squad, said yesterday. Spica started his black 1977 Cadillac in front of his home yesterday morning, and the ignition apparently touched off an explosion. Parts of Spica's body were spattered on his home 20 feet away, and part of the car landed on the roof of the two-story building. Windows were shattered throughout the quiet residential neighborhood in suburban Richmond Heights. Slayton said, "We're assuming it was dynamite, placed either under the front seat of the car or under the car itself." One policeman at the scene said it appeared that a bomb containing at least 10 sticks of dynamite had been planted beneath the seat of the car, which was parked outside Spica's apartment. Spica, 42, was a brother-in-law of Russell Byers, a key figure in the investigation by the House Select Committee on Assassinations of the King killing. Spica was in the Missouri State Penitentiary at the same time as King's convicted killer, James Earl Ray, before King was killed. The committee has looked into reports that Byers was offered $50,000 for King's assassination from conservative businessmen in the St. Louis area. Spica was mentioned as a possible link between Byers and Ray. "There was never any definite Spica connection to the assassination," said Conrad Bates, an investigator for the committee. "We firmly established that he did have a lot of underworld connections. That in itself could be the reason for him to be blown up." In 1962, Spica was charged with the hit-for-pay killing of John Misak, a St. Louis County real estate man who was shot to death on the driveway of his home. While serving his life sentence in the state penitentiary, Spica was given additional concurrent sentences for two previous crimes. He also met James Earl Ray there, although he denied before the assassinations committee that he passed him word of a contract for killing Martin Luther King.
And those of you who are
Radio Free America.
Obviously, it remains to be seen just exactly whether John Paul Spica was involved in the assassination of Dr. King or whether he had any information about it. Obviously, we're not about to find out, at least not from him. I've never heard anything more about that lead being followed up either. So again, for archival purposes, there it is. And we're going to be coming back. We're going to take a short musical break now, and then we're going to come back with some more information, and we're going to talk about we're going to review some information about the physical circumstances of King's killing, and we're going to talk about the curious behavior of Jesse Jackson with regard to the assassination of Dr. King. Musical break, and then back with more information.
Oh, Dad. The pipes are calling, yeah.
Broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC Los Altos Hills. Welcome back once again to Radio Free America. We're adding on right now to Radio Free America program number 8, dealing, of course, with the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. Let me tell you a couple of things. First of all, if for some reason you have been unable to tape tonight's broadcast, if you tuned in late, or if you had to leave early, you're probably not listening now, but if you're listening in your car, and for whatever reason were unable to tape, be aware that master copies of all of these broadcasts are available from a tape duplication service. Quickly, that service is Archives on Audio, Box 170023, Box 170023, that's in San Francisco, zip code 94117-0023. Phone 415-346-1840, write or phone to the attention of Paul, and again, neither myself nor the station makes money out of this arrangement. We're going to now to review, where we're going to add some information and review some information from earlier in the broadcast concerning the actual physical circumstances of Dr. King's assassination. This by way of gaining a better grasp of just what the situation in Memphis on April 4th, 1968 was like. We're going to do this in order to set the stage for an examination of some curious behavior by Jesse Jackson, which actually continues to date, concerning Dr. King's assassination. Jesse Jackson, of course, being the man who has assumed Dr. King's mantle, so to speak. And before we get into Jesse per se, we're going to look a little bit at the circumstances. Again, some of this is review, but at the circumstances of Dr. King's assassination. Reading again from the House Select Committee on Assassinations report, from which I read a short time ago, on page 409, concerning the Lorraine Motel that Dr. King was staying in. The committee investigated the possibility that the FBI's COINTELPRO effort influenced Dr. King's decision to be in Memphis on April 4, 1968, and more specifically to stay at the Lorraine Motel. The committee determined that Dr. King had been designated as a man to be discredited as early as December of 1963. One more time. The committee determined that Dr. King had been designated as a man to be discredited as early as December of 1963. Of course, that's right after President Kennedy's assassination. On August 25, 1967, FBI headquarters directed 22 field offices, including Memphis, to commence COINTELPRO activities against black nationalist hate groups, unquote. The purpose of the directive, as reflected in supporting documents, was to expose, disrupt, misdirect, or otherwise neutralize the activities of specified organizations, including the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC. Instructions were issued, quote, that no opportunities be overlooked for counterintelligence action, unquote. On March 4, 1968, a second memo was issued expanding the COINTELPRO effort to include 44 field offices and for the first time specifically naming Dr. King. Several goals of COINTELPRO were set out. One of them was, quote, to prevent the rise of a messiah, quote, unquote, who could unify and electrify the militant black nationalist movement, unquote. The memo continued, Malcolm X might have been such a messiah. Martin Luther King, Stokely Carmichael, and Elijah Muhammad all aspire to this position. King could be a very real contender for this position should he abandon his supposed obedience to white liberal doctrines, nonviolence, and embrace black nationalism. For the first time, specific reporting requirements were established with the first response due from all offices within 30 days. Imagination and initiative were stressed, although specific operations were to be approved by headquarters to avoid embarrassment to the Bureau. Well, much has been written and said of the COINTELPRO operation, in which a number of highly illegal activities were engaged in order to discredit or in some cases kill some of the individuals targeted. We're not going to go into this right now. Suffice it to say, the COINTELPRO program was dealt with at great length in Radio Free America number 23. What we're going to do now is go ahead and play an excerpt from a Hard Rain show from January of 1981. This is going to review some of the information from Jeff Cohen's essay about the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. Then we're going to hear Dr. King's I Have Been to the Mountaintop speech, and then we're going to take a look at what Jesse Jackson has been doing with regard to the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. So a lot of the tape you're about to hear is review. Also, we're going to listen to Dr. King's I Have Been to the Mountaintop speech, which is will give us an idea of just what was going through Dr. King's mind at the time. Actually, let's see how this runs time-wise. We might not have time for the I Have Been to the Mountaintop speech because I have another speech scheduled for later. So we may just have the information that reviews the physical circumstances at the Lorraine Motel, because this is relevant to Jesse Jackson's curious behavior on this day. So we'll see. We may not have time for the I Have Been to the Mountaintop speech, and we'll include that in a future broadcast, because there is going to be an archive show about Jesse Jackson at some point in the future. So here's from the Old Hard Rain show of January of 1981, some information concerning the physical circumstances of the assassination.
Would, as I said, would have been 52 years old on the 15th of this month. Next week we will be talking about the accelerating racist violence in the United States. Well, today's program is going to be a little different even from most Hard Rain broadcasts. We're going to begin by looking at a couple of the main aspects of the controversy surrounding Dr. King's assassination. We'll begin by examining the incredible testimony of professional drunkard Charles Q. Stevens, S-T-E-P-H-E-N-S. Charles Q. Stevens was the only witness to connect James Earl Ray with the rooming house from which he supposedly fired the shot that took Dr. King's life. Now, Ray has maintained his innocence all along. He claims he was framed. Stevens, who was so drunk at the time of the killing that in his initial statement he said he didn't recall anybody being shot at all. Well, Stevens had his memory curiously refreshed by $31,000 worth of wining and dining at the hands of the FBI. After that, we will take a look at the various eyewitness accounts of the fatal shot having been fired from a group of bushes beneath the window Ray allegedly fired from. And we will also look at the testimony of a ballistics expert to the effect that Ray could not possibly have fired the shot from where he was alleged to have fired it from. In the last part of the discussion will center on the so-called Eggs and Sausages man, who was one of the leading suspects in the Martin Luther King assassination case. Most of the program will consist of Dr. King's famous I Have Been to the Mountaintop speech, which was delivered in Memphis, Tennessee on the evening of April 3rd, 1968, which was the night before the day on which he was killed. And we're going to begin, as I said, by looking at the background of the chief prosecution witness against James Earl Ray, that being a man named Charles Q. Stevens. All of the information we're going to be discussing this evening will be coming from an essay entitled The Assassination of Martin Luther King. And that essay was written by Jeff Cohen, C-O-H-E-N. And Jeff Cohen's The Assassination of Martin Luther King is contained in an anthology entitled Government by Gunplay. Government by Gunplay was co-edited by Sid Blumenthal and Harvey Yazijian, Y-A-Z-I-J-I-A-N, and Government by Gunplay was published in 1976 in paperback by Signet Books. And of Chief Prosecution Witness Charles Q. Stevens, Cohen writes in The Assassination of Martin Luther King, saying, "One of the shoddiest aspects of the police-FBI investigation was the selection of Charles Q. Stevens as the state's star witness. On the night of the slaying, Stevens, a rumor, told Memphis reporter Wayne Chastain, C-H-A-S-T-A-I-N, quote, 'I saw who done it. It was a nigger. I saw him run out of the bathroom. I will never testify against the man who killed Martin Luther Coon, even if it were a nigger who done it,' unquote." Bessie Brewer overheard Stevens' statement and told reporter Chastain to disregard it. "He was so drunk he didn't see or hear anything," unquote. Lloyd Jowers, J-O-W-E-R-S, the manager of Jim's Cafe, located below the rooming house, testified that Stevens was inebriated that afternoon. Cab driver James McGraw testified at the 1974 hearing for Ray that Stevens was drunk at 5:45 p.m., 15 minutes before King was killed. Stevens, who had phoned for a cab, quote, was lying on the bed and couldn't get up. He was falling down drunk, unquote. Private Stone, a fireman, stated that Stevens visited the nearby station every night at 6 p.m. intoxicated, unquote. According to press photographer Ernest Withers, the day after the murder, Stevens didn't recall that someone had been shot. Stevens' original statement to the police was that he saw nothing, that he was in the kitchen where he could not see what happened. Accordingly, he was ignored by the police and FBI. But 6 weeks later, Stevens declared that his memory was reawakened after Ray's picture appeared on the front pages. The man he saw was not only Lily White, he said, but was James Earl Ray. Stevens claimed he heard the shot fired from the bathroom and saw Ray run out with a rifle. Stevens became the only eyewitness who would link the accused assassin to the murder scene. If Ray's London attorney had known of Stevens' original police statement, the nigger story, his drunken condition, or his police record containing 155 arrests, it is likely that Ray would not have been extradited at all. During the extradition hearings, the FBI took Stevens into protective custody at posh motels, gave him money, openly paid his drinking bills at Jim's Cafe, and hid him from the press. It cost the taxpayers $31,000 to hold the state's star witness, according to the Memphis police chief. Well, a little later, in the assassination of Martin Luther King, Jeff Cohen goes on to describe the numerous eyewitness accounts of the fatal shot having been fired from a group of bushes beneath the window that Ray allegedly fired from. Of these eyewitness accounts, Cohen says, where was the gunman? Several eyewitnesses contend the gunman fired from the rooming house backyard where bushes atop an embankment faced King's Motel across the street. Yes, a grassy knoll, unquote. At the instant he was shot, Martin Luther King was leaning over a second-floor motel balcony talking to his chauffeur, Solomon Jones, who was on the ground floor. Jones said that King seemed to be lifted off the balcony by the bullet. This upward trajectory suggests a lower assassin's perch more consistent with the bushes than the second floor window. I heard the shot and turned around and saw a man with a white sheet on his face in some bushes over there, unquote, and Jones recounted. When the gunman hunkered down again, unquote, as if he were going to fire another shot, Jones took cover. When the chauffeur looked up seconds later, he thought he saw the same man, without white sheet and rifle, walk out of the bushes and casually join firemen running toward the motel. Rumor Harold Cornbread Carter told police that he had been drinking wine in the bushes at 6 p.m. when he heard a shot ring loudly in his ear. Cornbread looked around and saw a man flee by him so close, he kicked gravel on me, unquote. An 11-year-old black youth saw a white man jump down from the bushes onto the street soon after the shot. And the 11-year-old ran 100 yards to the nearby fire station, told what he saw to three firemen, and was whisked to police headquarters. Two police detectives who were surveilling King from a concealed position in the firehouse watched him get struck. They believe the shot came from the nearby bushes, not from the window 20 feet above. Bertie Reeves and Willie Auschultz, A-U-S-C-H-U-L-T-Z, two ear witnesses, unquote, located inside the rooming house, said, the shot came from the bushes, unquote. Ballistics expert Herbert McDonnell, M-A-C-D-O-N-E-L-L, testified at Ray's 1974 hearing that there was no way, unquote, the rifle said to have killed King could have been fired from the rooming house bathroom window. After examining a dented windowsill on which the state maintains Ray rested his rifle, McDonnell declared that to get the proper angle, the rifle would have stuck 6 inches into the wall, unquote. The state contends that Ray twisted himself into a contorted firing position, straddling the rim of the bathtub. Ray's attorney, Bernard Fensterwald, remarked, it's inconceivable to me that no one from the defense would have examined the room to see if a shot was possible from that window. There's no proof that the bullet was fired from that window, and there's lots of evidence to show that it was from somewhere else, unquote. Dr. J.T. Francisco, who was originally assigned by the court to determine the circumstances and cause of death, testified, quote, from my findings, I could not exclude other sites than the bathroom window as the source of the bullet, unquote. Ballistics expert McDonnell also contested the FBI ballistics report, which stated, quote, due to mutilation, no conclusion could be drawn that the submitted bullet from King's body came from the submitted rifle bought by Ray, unquote. McDonnell argued that an identification could have been possible if the rifle had been test-fired to examine the slugs. It was not. Well, still later, Cohen goes on to describe the circumstances surrounding the appearance of the eggs and sausages man, who, as I said at the top of the broadcast, was one of the leading suspects, is one of the leading suspects in the assassination of Martin Luther King. This information also was presented by Memphis reporter Wayne Chastain, who had formerly worked for the Memphis Press Scimitar. Of the eggs and sausages man, Cohen writes, 90 minutes before King was slain, a dark, athletically built man entered Jim's Cafe and ordered eggs and sausage, no liquor. Manager Lloyd Jowers and the waitress say they will never forget this well-dressed, sober man who fit about as well in this Skid Row Cafe as Nelson Rockefeller at a Poor People's March. The man appeared irritated as he walked to the phone twice but did not make a call. An hour after he paid his bill and left, Jowers heard an exploding sound in the back of his cafe. Jowers and the waitress contend that the eggs and sausage man, not Ray, killed King. When asked about suspicious persons, Jowers mentioned the eggs and sausages man to police and was told to call them if he ever showed up again. Jowers was startled the following morning when the suspicious stranger returned. A different waitress took his order, eggs and sausage. Jowers called the cops and they picked him up after breakfast. The man was apparently held by Memphis police for the FBI, who quickly released him. That night, a police captain told Jowers, quote, "That eggs and sausage guy you put us on must have had some real connections. One phone call, and he was gone. He wasn't in the station more than an hour," unquote. Five days later, Memphis attorney Russell X. Thompson was visited by a mystery man who introduced himself as Tony Benavides, Benavides, and then admitted, "It's an alias," unquote. According to Thompson, Benavides claimed to know how the King assassination actually occurred, not the way it was reported in the press, unquote. Thompson's visitor said the shot did not come from the rooming house, but from a clump of bushes, unquote, on a wall across the street from the motel. Benavides' panoramic description of the murder scene convinced Thompson that his strange guest had, in fact, been an eyewitness. "I can tell you for sure I looked out that bathroom window. You could not have squeezed off a bullet and hit King from that spot. There were trees, for one thing. The angle of elevation is another." And Cohen interjects here, "Days after the murder, trees that could have obstructed a second-story sniper were cleared." Benavides continued, "The gunman jumped from the wall to the sidewalk. He moved with the crowd toward the motel. He was not suspected because he was running toward the scene, not away from it." And Jones interjects, or Cohen interjects again, "Remember chauffeur Jones' almost identical description." During the 75-minute conversation, Benavides claimed to be a professional gunman, unquote, and performed a disappearing gun trick for the startled attorney. Thompson took copious notes of Benavides' talk. "I believe my roommate killed King. It will be my lousy luck that the police will arrest me and charge me with King's murder. They picked me up last Friday, the same day the eggs and sausages man was arrested and released," Cohen interjects again. Could Benavides be the eggs and sausages man? Through photographs shown to them by reporter Chastain and attorney Thompson, Jowers and the waitress have identified the eggs and sausage man and Benavides as one and the same person, a man named Jack Youngblood, Youngblood. Youngblood, according to Chastain, is a marksman and soldier of fortune who has worked with the CIA against Cuba and had a book ghostwritten about his exploits during Batista's last months. A high-ranking Memphis police official told Chastain that the eggs and sausage man was an FBI informant and an Army intelligence agent. Jack Youngblood contended in his conversation with Thompson that his Denver roommate, not Youngblood himself, had pulled the trigger. Youngblood provided the attorney with the address of a Denver rooming house. When Thompson investigated the Denver dwelling, he discovered that a man fitting Youngblood's description had actually lived there. 4 hours after his lengthy conversation with Thompson, Youngblood introduced himself to two ministers under a different alias and proceeded to make a similar presentation and confession. Youngblood told the attorney and the clergyman that the King killer had impersonated a black man in setting up the assassination. And keep that in mind as Cohen relates an incident which occurred shortly before Dr. King was killed. Cohen writes, "A day before King arrived in Memphis, in fact, the manager of the black-owned and operated Lorraine Motel was visited by an advance security man for Dr. King," unquote. When the advance man saw that King's suite was on the first floor, he told the manager, "No, no, Mrs. Bailey, this simply won't do. Dr. King always likes to stay on the second floor overlooking a swimming pool," unquote. When the advance man departed, the manager scoffed at an employee's suspicion that the security officer had been a white man imitating a black, unquote. King's accommodations were moved upstairs, where he was shot on the second floor balcony. The advance man remains a mystery to King's associates. No advance man had been assigned for his Memphis arrival, and no one in King's entourage fit the description. In 1968, Ray told author Bradford Huey, H-U-I-E, he had an uncomfortable feeling he was being tailed that fateful day in Memphis by a man he bumped into twice in separate taverns. "He looked at me kind of funny," Ray stated. The escapee hoped that the tail was Raoul's gun-smuggling contact and not a police agent. From a photograph shown to him by Wayne Chastain in May of 1974, Ray identified the suspicious man as Jack Youngblood. So what does it all mean? Three witnesses can place Youngblood at the murder scene. Three more can testify to his reputed knowledge of a plot. Why did he visit Thompson and the clergyman? Law enforcement agencies apparently aren't interested in finding the answer. The FBI and Memphis police shunned the evidence offered by Chastain and Thompson. Well, as I mentioned at the top of the broadcast, the balance of the program is going to consist of Dr. King's "I Have Been to the Mountaintop" speech, which was made in Memphis, Tennessee, on the evening of April 3rd, 1968, the evening before the day on which he was killed. And keep in mind, as you listen to Dr. King's last speech, that as he came to the bloody pass, he was aware that the advance man who had arranged for him to stay on the second floor of the Lorraine Motel overlooking the pool was not his advance man.
Okay, we're not going to hear the "I Have Been to the Mountaintop" speech because we're really not going to have time for that this evening. We're going to be coming back to Jesse Jackson, not only reviewing the material we're presenting this evening and dealing with other material as well. We're going to be dealing with Jesse Jackson, and we'll review that "I Have Been to the Mountaintop" speech in the upcoming archive show about Jesse Jackson. A couple of people called during the broadcast and noted, or during that last tape segment, noted that in fact that material was identical to material earlier in the broadcast. I know that was done deliberately so people would have an impression of the physical circumstances fresh in their mind, because now we're going to take a look at where Jesse was and what he was doing on that fateful day, namely April 4th of 1968. Returning again to the report of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, from which I read earlier on a couple of occasions, we're going to take a look now at where Jesse was. Basically, Jesse was on the ground below the balcony of the Lorraine Motel where King was killed, and it was when King went out to talk to Jesse Jackson and a couple of other people concerning dinner that Dr. King was assassinated. The Kyles here, K-Y-L-E-S, is a King aide. Kyles recalled that Dr. King asked Abernathy to get his top coat and then called to Jackson. "Jesse, I want you to go to dinner with us this evening," unquote, but urged him not to bring the entire breadbasket band. Kyles chided Dr. King, quote, "Doc, Jesse had arranged that even before you had," unquote. Kyles then stood on the balcony with Dr. King for a moment, finally saying, "Come on, it's time to go." Kyles turned and walked away to go down to his car. After a few steps, Kyles called to lawyer Eskridge in the courtyard below, "Chauncey, are you going with me? I'm going to get the car." At 6:01 p.m., as Dr. King stood behind the iron balcony railing in front of the room of room 306, the report of a high-powered rifle cracked the air. A slug tore into the right side of his face, violently throwing him backward. So again, it was as King was standing on the balcony talking to, among others, Jesse Jackson down below that he was slain.
We're going to skip down in the account, and the only subsequent discussion here of Jesse Jackson in the House Select Committee report, which is the House Select Committee's investigation was badly compromised, but the only other discussion of Jesse Jackson being around Dr. King here is as follows. Again, skipping down in the report, Lee Jackson and Williams, that's Hosea Williams, had followed Young, that's Andrew Young, up the steps from the courtyard to room 306. Dr. King's head still lay in a pool of blood. Abernathy, kneeling over his friend, tried desperately to save Dr. King's life. Several of the men on that balcony pointed in the direction of the shot. Frozen in a picture taken by photographer James Lau, L-O-U-W, they were aiming their index fingers across Mulberry Street and northwest of room 306. An ambulance arrived at the Lorraine about 5 minutes after Dr. King had been shot, according to Abernathy. By this time, police officers cluttered the courtyard, quote-unquote. Abernathy accompanied the unconscious Dr. King to the emergency room of St. Joseph Hospital. The 39-year-old civil rights leader, described by Abernathy as, quote, the most peaceful warrior of the 20th century, was pronounced dead at 7:05 p.m. April 4th of 1968. There's no discussion there of Jesse Jackson cradling Dr. King's head, because initially, although he's since changed his story, that's what Jesse Jackson has claimed. Now, again, bear in mind, Jesse initially was beneath the balcony on which Dr. King stood. In fact, Dr. King was out to talk to Jesse about dinner when he was slain. The behavior of Jesse Jackson and the controversy surrounding his account, which has since been changed, of his behavior immediately after the assassination of Dr. King, well, that controversy endures to this day, and it's worth noting that it was Jesse's grandstanding after the assassination of Dr. King that helped propel him into the public eye.